Good morning and welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Miss Amy. How? You're back in America.
I'm back in America and I'm happy to be back. Gosh, it was a great trip, but there are certain things you miss when you're not in the United States.
You miss your shooting?
I missed my shooting.
And
I
your
missed,
chickens?
I missed ice.
Ice?
I missed ice. But by the way, I came home and I now have 5 chickens laying eggs.
Wow.
I left with 3 and now they're 5. Almost
nice.
Pretty. When I'm at full capacity, I'll have 9 eggs a day.
And what do you do with them all?
Well, I've got friends in the neighborhood.
I mean, 9 a day, though. That's, you got to have a lot of friends.
It's a lot. Well, we'll talk about that another time. We've got a lot of great guests this morning. And I did miss y'all, but you had a great show last week. I listened to it while I was working out this week.
Yeah, Chad did a good job.
Yeah, very informative, and Chad did a great job. We have a wonderful jam-packed show this morning, a lot of different types of guests. If you're an entrepreneur, if you are a business owner, listen up because we've got a lot of great folks here to talk to you. But first up this morning, we have Brent Morris. And Brent's here to talk to us about a brand new Dunwoody Fall Festival coming to Dunwoody. So give us the specifics, Brent.
Thank you, Amy, for having us. And we're very, very excited. Through the Dunwoody Chamber of Commerce this year, we're going to be putting on the first annual Dunwoody Fall Festival and Chili Cook-Off. It's going to be progressing in the future years into a Dunwoody Fall Music Festival.
Ooh, I like that.
Yes, hopefully something along the lines of the Savannah Music Festival. We'll make it much more exciting and interesting for the residents and also people throughout the nation to come visit Dunwoody.
Great. You know, on, it was April 15th, we had a City of Dunwoody show and learned a lot about the City of Dunwoody. But I understand with the new city, there's a new chamber. What really prompted this event?
Great question. The Chamber of Commerce essentially wants to promote business in Dunwoody. But one of our really important parts of the Chamber of Commerce is to really go out there and do things for the community itself. And we thought this would be a great way to give back to the community and put on a festival that would the community could relate to and the businesses could relate to.
That sounds great. Now, I understand there's a chili cook-off. You know I love to eat. I love to cook. Tell us the specifics on that.
Quite frankly, this is where my heart lies in the event. The chili cook-off will have 30 to 50 contestants. We've got prizes, cash prizes from $1,000 for first place, $500 for second place, $250 for third, and a $500 People's Choice Award. And it should be one spectacular event. Come out, you can get an armband and go through the tasting line and try everything out. We've got judges from McKendrick Steakhouse, Fleming Steakhouse, the Crown Plaza Ravinia, and the W Hotel.
And I understand the mayor is going to be there to taste.
The mayor has agreed to, I guess, forfeit his palate for the day and come out and try some chili.
Now, what made you guys go with chili into the event? How'd you add chili out of all the, you know, infinite things?
Chili probably because it's fall and because most people can relate to a simple dish like that rather than doing a taste of Dunwoody.
That's been done.
There are plenty of tastes out there. So we thought it would be kind of fun to have a giant tailgate party.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And this is the one Georgia bye weekend. And the man upstairs told me that there wasn't going to be any rain this year.
Good. Perfect.
On that day.
There you go.
Good. So it's October 24th.
Correct.
What time does it start?
From 10 a.m. until 6 p.m.
And is it a good thing to take my family to?
That would be ideal. We've got kids' bouncies. We've got 20 craft vendors. We've got the Knights of Columbus, the Rotary Club cooking barbecue, brats, hot dogs. It's just going to be a great time.
Now, aside from chili, there's other you said there's lots of other food, right? So if you're not a big chili fan.
There are plenty of other things to eat. And along that, along those lines, we also have a pumpkin patch for the kids.
Cool.
Hopefully some face painting and a dunking booth. So, Lee, if you're interested in being in the dunking booth.
Me and Amy will go side by side.
Excellent.
Hey, now, is that water heated? It could be kind of cold. Okay, so is there an admission fee?
No, actually, admission is free.
Wow.
The chili tasting itself is $5, and the kids' rides, the kids' bounties will be sold by tickets. And those are $1 a piece, or you can get an armband to do all day.
And where's the location of the event?
The location is at 5518 Chamblee Dunwoody Road, right in the heart of Dunwoody. It's actually in Dunwoody Village, mm-hmm. and right between the Goodyear and Walgreens.
Are there still spots available if folks want to sponsor it?
There are sponsors still available. Thank you for asking. They range from $250 up to $6,000.
Okay.
We've got an awful lot of 250 sponsors, but the top sponsors right now are Bill Grant Homes and the Dunwoody Crier. And the Dunwoody Crier is just phenomenal at sponsoring these events.
Absolutely.
But we welcome more sponsors.
And if folks want to learn about more, is there a website?
There is. Thank you. And that's www.dunwoodyfallfestival.com.
I'm not sure you'll see me in the dunking booth there, but I'm sure I'll be there tasting some chili.
That would be great. We would appreciate that.
Wonderful. And this is sponsored by?
The Dunwoody Chamber of Commerce.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. And if people want to learn more about the Dunwoody Chamber of Commerce, too, it's a great organization, new, thriving, great way to promote your business in Dunwoody. Thanks for being with us today, Brent.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Great information. I don't know, Lee. I got to go try the cookie. Or try
you
the
like chili.
I'm just debating. I might enter.
Enter.
The chili.
There you go.
Should I?
I think you should.
The only thing that's kind of leading me in the other direction is you have to make your chili on site.
Why?
I don't know that I could. I licked my fingers too much. I think I probably have to wear gloves and a hairnet. I don't know.
Yeah, sounds like work.
It does. I'll just go and taste and eat and enjoy. Our next guest this morning is known by many, Cliff Oxford of the Entrepreneurial Advisors. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Cliff, tell us a little bit about Entrepreneurial Advisors and Entrepreneur Advisors and how you got your company started.
Well, you know, I spent 9 years with starting founder and CEO of STI Knowledge and had the great opportunity of building that company in the United States, throughout Hong Kong, Europe, South Africa. And then when I sold the company in 2003, there were some lessons I learned. Starting from scratch and building it to where we ended, which was about 750 employees. And one of the things I realized was that, you know, we all fall into mainly the same potholes when we're building a company. I fell in the same ones that many people fall into, and it's just how you get out of them. And what we hope to do at Entrepreneur Advisors is help people avoid those potholes. Mm-hmm. So we focus on companies between $5 million and $200 million that really have got themselves established and they're ready to take it, quote, to the next level.
Okay.
And we do investment banking, strategic consulting, and help them place them as a market leader, a category leader, and how to own a brand and not just have a company but have a movement.
And are there specific industries that you specialize in?
No, it's across the board. Today, of course, medical is very hot right now.
Right.
We have a lot of activity in medical, but we have some exciting things in technology. We have exciting things in food. So it's across the board.
This morning I was at a breakfast with McGraw-Hill. They were giving their 2010 forecast for the economy, and it was interesting. They were saying there's a rise in healthcare and education. Those are the two big areas that we'll see development in. What are you seeing as far as just the entrepreneurial mindset in the economy? I mean, what are you seeing as the outlook? And I mean, a lot of entrepreneurs look at this time as a great time and a time for opportunity, right?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of great companies built during depressions, Allstate, Intel, because it does kind of clear out the playing field. That's one of the great advantages, if there is one, of a recession, is that it clears out makes the field, the playing field a little clearer. But it's tough. I mean, I cannot mislead anyone on that. The entrepreneurs I deal with every day, and we deal with 10 to 12 new companies a week.
Wow.
We probably have 50 to 60 that we're engaged in right now. And it's very difficult. At the same time, it's a mindset. You know, you got to get up every morning and put one foot ahead of the next. And you got to say, you know, what can I do today that better than I did yesterday? And opportunities can happen. There's a lot of, you know, right now in government healthcare, you know, there's a big focus on reform. But I was at a surgery center conference last week with about 700 doctors, and there's a lot of exciting market things that's happening in healthcare. So it's tough, but it's very doable, and it's always a great time to start a business.
Now, how do you work with your clients? How hands-on is it? Is it more of you're teaching them to kind of learn on their own, or is it where your people come in and really kind of roll up their sleeves and get into their businesses?
Well, being an entrepreneur, you know, I've been accused of being a micromanager before. We tend to enjoy control, and so I can't help it. I'm into it up to my eyeballs. And, you know, right now I'm selling 7 surgery centers for doctors, and we're involved with them, although I have staff people that work with them also, but I know every one of those deals. I know who they need to contact, and I'm putting those deals together. We have people that are raising money that I'm involved with. So it's probably part of my personality, but I have to be, you know, in the playing field.
So you're very involved, it sounds like.
Yeah, very involved in every client that we have.
Now, I'm curious about the surgery centers. When you say there's a lot going on in healthcare, how much of that would you believe is technology-driven?
A lot of it right now is driven by the unknown and uncertainty, and sometimes fear do force decisions. And I think a lot of the doctors and a lot of medical communities says, you know, I don't know what's going to be around next year, so whatever value I have, I might as well go ahead and try to attract that value right now. And, you know, I use the word surgery centers. This was a very huge entrepreneurial effort in the medical community that's gone unnoticed. These are doctors who form their own hospitals.
Wow.
You know, and they do operations in the surgery centers, and they're totally owned by the doctors because the hospitals were generally inefficient and overpriced. So that started happening in the mid-1990s, and today there are over 4,700 surgery centers in the United States.
That's an unusual combination, physician slash entrepreneur. Those are two totally different mindsets. How do you find dealing with clients, managing the personalities, and have you ever dealt with anybody where you just think, gosh, this person isn't an entrepreneur at all? I mean, how do you ever tell someone, maybe you should just give it up and get a day job?
You know, that's a very good question, because people come to see me and see our company, and they got big dreams.
Right.
But, you know, you don't want any disappoint anybody's dreams.
Sure.
But 80% of the time, it's not going to happen. I mean, that's the pure facts of it. And certainly I've made my share of mistakes, and I don't know everything and far from it. But there are certain things you can tell now when I sit down with people, because at the end of the day, a company comes down to the personality of its leader. No matter how many people you hire 700 or 7,000, the company's going to reflect the leader, the personality of the leader. And that leader's got to have certain traits. And if those certain traits aren't there, then the chance of success is quite low.
What are some of those traits?
You know, can you sell on potential, not just on promise? You know, I remember when I was starting my first company, you know, we'd leave meetings and my people would look at me and say, you know, we can't do that. And I'm like, yeah, we can do that. We don't have that today, but we can have it tomorrow. Whereas the people who wants to get it perfect before they go out to market with it.
Mm-hmm. So that's a bad mindset.
That's a bad mindset. Quite often engineers have that mindset. The second one, can you tell everybody else they're doing it wrong and you're going to do it right? I mean, you got to come riding in on a pretty big white horse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about a growth business here.
Sure.
Certainly not, you know, the mom and pops, which certainly play a vital role in the economy, but I'm talking about a growth business. You've got to be able to be laughed at. You know, anytime everybody's told me I had slam dunk decisions, I've made no money on those endeavors.
Wow.
So avoid that slam dunk.
Avoid the slam dunk. When I've made money is when people looked at me and said, that's impossible, and they literally laughed at me. And can you withstand that laughter, and can that give you more motivation?
Sure.
So those are just some of the traits.
So you have to be resilient.
Resilient, be able to declare leadership, being able to say, I'm the market category and here's why. Those are some of the traits. And again, you know, let's get it out of the lab and into the operating environment. Let's not just let's go out and can the CEO sell? I mean, at the end of the day, that's a big trait.
Really?
When I see people and they come in, I say, can this CEO be a salesperson? Because you're not just selling product and services, you're selling a vision, you're selling values.
Sure.
So if the CEO can't sell, you know, more than likely the chance of success is very low.
Tell us about entrepreneur economics.
Well, entrepreneur economics is about 300 entrepreneurs here in Atlanta, and we meet once a month, and it's a combination of two of my passions, commerce and education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I endowed the Emory MBA program in 2004, and one of the reasons I endowed the Emory MBA program was not only that I had graduated from there in 94, but I wanted it to focus on entrepreneurs and have an entrepreneurial community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, entrepreneurs are not going to go sit in a Chamber of Commerce meeting and talk about water policy, although that's very important. What they want to talk about is how can I get smarter today and how can I make money tomorrow?
Sure.
And that's what entrepreneur economics is about. We meet, like I said, once a month. And it's when you get 300 people in the room, entrepreneurs in a room, good things happen. Everybody always asks me, how do you plan such great meetings? And I go, well, the hard part is getting everybody here.
Yeah.
Then it kind of takes care of itself. So we focus on commerce and education. We focus on letting these people sell to each other. But there's the very smart ones do this. They focus not only the people in the room, but all the clients of the people in the room.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So that grew out of my affiliation with Emory. And I invite everyone. It's October the 30th. The next meeting is October the 30th at the Ritz-Carlton from 8 a.m. till noon. And send me cliffoxford@yahoo.com, and I'll get you an invitation. So that's entrepreneur economics. And it's a combination of commerce and education.
And what kind of entrepreneur is invited to this? Is it anybody with a business, or you have to have a minimum number of sales per year?
No, anybody that wants to be a brand leader, whether you're one person or 1,000 people, if you want to be a brand leader, if you want to say, I want to own a market category, I want to be the best in my segment, we certainly would invite everyone.
Terrific. Any final thoughts for our listeners? Any advice for the entrepreneurs listening?
If you were going to do one thing, what would that be?
As an entrepreneur?
Yeah.
If you want to be an entrepreneur, and especially if you're looking at starting a business, first thing I tell people is go find a customer. That's a great way to start a business. Go find yourself a customer. Don't go look for money. Don't go to the VCs. Don't go to the financial community. They will fund a Google or a Microsoft, but you waste a lot of time. And all that time you're putting towards trying to raise, quote, money from angel investors, you could be finding a customer and then get the customer to prepay you. If you can do that, if you can find a customer and get the customer to prepay you.
You got a shot.
You have a shot.
Wow, I'd say.
And then if people want to learn more about your firm, what's the website of that?
Entrepreneuradvisors.com.
Great. Thanks for being with us today, Cliff.
Thank you for having us.
We appreciate the information.
Thank you.
Next, hot off the press, Lee, we get some great requests from PR folks letting us know about new things happening in Atlanta. But this one excites me for a couple of reasons. We have the author of an incredible book here, David Rubel, who is here to talk to us about the brand new book coming out tomorrow, I believe, If I Had a Hammer, Building Homes and Hope with Habitat for Humanity. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
So, David, tell us, you've got a lot of experience. Before we get started, though, I'm curious about the culinary thing. When I was reading your bio, I was like, wow, this sounds like an interesting guy. You had your own radio show for a while.
I did. I did a segment on a public radio network in the Northeast where I live called What's for Dinner, and it was presenting recipes that fathers and mothers, the dad, cook, and the family, could make for their kids on a school night so they wouldn't have to eat so much prepared food.
Like hamburgers on the grill?
Hamburgers on the grill works, but more like...
More complex than that?
Chicken cutlets, some Chinese recipes. I got a wok, and I know how to use it.
Wow.
I like that. That's interesting because as I was reading your bio, of course, I love food. That sparked my interest. So tell us a little bit more about the Habitat for Humanity, your involvement, and, we're really anxious to hear about the book.
Well, for me, it was really serendipitous, Amy, because I got a call from Habitat for Humanity. They were interested in reaching out to young adults, and as an author, I have a lot of experience writing for kids in junior high school age. And Habitat, as you probably know, to work on a Habitat job site, you have to be 16 or 18, depending on what part of the country you're in, because construction sites can be kind of dangerous, and
sure.
So you have to be an adult. But Habitat, like any good business, is always looking for what its future will be, and a good businessman's thinking, where are my next clients going to come from? And a good organization like Habitat has to think about, where are my next volunteers going to come from? And what this book does is use the stories of Habitat volunteers and homeowners to explain what the organization does and to try to inspire kids to become more involved with it as they get older. They can already be involved in certain ways, fundraising, doing support work for affiliates, but as they get older, they can volunteer, and not only for Habitat, for all kinds of good service organizations.
For our listeners that aren't familiar with Habitat of Humanity, what is their mission?
Habitat's mission is actually pretty simple. It's to rid the world of poverty housing. And they define poverty housing as really a place that you or I probably wouldn't even think of as a home, a place that has no running water, a place that doesn't have an adequate roof, a place that has no heat in the winter. And As you can imagine, there are many people all over the world who live in those situations. Of the 6 billion people in the world, half of them live on less than $2 a day. That just doesn't give them much for housing. And so they're living in situations that are really hard for them to get ahead in any way as an entrepreneur or just as a person. And it seems in some ways that that's kind of an amazing thing to try to do, to get rid of all the poverty housing in the world. Well, Habitat's already built more than 300,000 homes that house millions of people, and it keeps growing. The model on which it works is really incredibly clever, and if a business person could figure out a way to harness it, it would be enormously profitable. Mm-hmm. What Habitat does is they raise money to buy construction materials. And as you probably know, there are two costs that go into building a house, materials and labor. And by far the biggest cost is labor. Mm-hmm. The volunteers provide the labor. You don't need that much money to buy the construction materials, and the house is built. And
Can you just drill it down to, like, say here in America, somebody wants to do a Habitat house, like how much money it needs to be raised in order to build a house?
Depending on what part of the country you're talking about, right, between $30,000 and $60,000.
So now, like, if somebody wants to, like, say a group wants to do this, so then they would raise those funds? Is that how it works?
Exactly. Very often, people just donate to Habitat, and those funds are aggregated to pay for it. Mm-hmm. But in many parts of the country, and affiliates are really good at that, is engaging with a business that can afford to do all of that or part of that.
Right.
And they not only provide the capital for the materials, but also provide the labor.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So a medium-sized company can easily use its employee base.
How much how many people is needed about to build a house?
Well, it's one of those things where the fewer people, the longer it takes.
Right. But it's probably a number of hours, right?
A very common model is that companies will commit to 4 weekends. Mm-hmm. And usually if you can put together 75 people or so, mm-hmm, you have no problem in getting it done in four weekends.
Really? You can build a house in four weekends?
Habitat has a great base of contractors who work with them who know building back and forth. And you have to remember, the Habitat homes are simple, decent homes. They're not McMansions or anything like that.
Right. They're functional.
And in fact, the people who volunteer typically have no construction experience at all.
You don't need any construction
experience? None at all. The way the system works is that each house has a house leader who's a building professional for the most part. And that person shows you what to do.
And like, what are some of the tasks that you do when you're volunteering?
Well, a lot of it involves hammering, as you can imagine.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Putting up the wood frames is a very common thing, which means taking 2x4s and nailing them together to form the walls and the stud plates. Shingling, that's kind of a fun thing to do. You get up on the roof with a hammer and you lay out your shingles and knock in the nails.
Right.
Painting. Mm-hmm. So these are all things that people can learn to do really quickly.
Right.
So I imagine you had to do a lot of research for your book. What did you find to be the most interesting Habitat type home throughout the globe? Because I understand the need would be different in India as opposed to South Georgia. Any stories for us?
Well, you're absolutely right that one of Habitat's biggest issues is how to build something that makes sense within the community in which they're building it. To drop in a U.S.-style home in the middle of India makes no sense.
Sure.
So designs are adapted. In many parts of the country, in many parts of the world, there isn't timber available cheaply to build homes with, so other materials are used. In India, for example, they use cement blocks, and the houses are built with window bars to keep out the monkeys.
Of course.
Not an issue in Georgia.
Right.
A big issue in India.
Right.
Also, the same houses have really high front steps to keep out the snakes.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And if you don't have the sort of local knowledge you need, you're going to build a really inappropriate house. There's a funny story that the head of design at Habitat told me about. They partnered with a group that was expert in water and sanitation issues that built, with some Habitat homes, some outdoor toilets, essentially outhouses. And this was at a town on the coast of Africa where for generations untold, people had used the ocean as their outhouse. Right. And so they built these outhouses, and a year later they came back, and they found out that they were being used as chicken coops because who would want to use an outhouse when you've got the ocean?
Right.
So, that's the sort of thing that Habitat's really good at knowing what to do. Sure. They have people on the ground in locally, 90 countries.
In the actual
exactly.
place. So.
They're active in 90 countries. In each of those countries, they have. It's not Americans going there telling them what to do. It's local
right.
people who know what the native people need, what the needy people in the area need in order to survive, and that's sure. what's provided to them.
Now, how has President Carter inspired Habitat volunteers? I know he wrote the foreword for your book, correct?
He did, which... for which I'm enormously grateful. Meeting President Carter is a great treat. And actually, President Carter will be signing the book tomorrow at the Carter Center from 5 to 6.
Oh, wow.
Which
with you? Or
with me.
Great.
So you get two for the price.
Wow. Of you and him.
Most people don't know. They think maybe President Carter started Habitat.
Right. He's very closely affiliated with it.
Habitat started in 1976, and President Carter didn't become involved till 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And most people think that he founded it because really not many people knew about Habitat before President Carter became
right.
involved. And at first, he just got on the board of directors and helped with fundraising. But he was visiting New York, and an eager young entrepreneurial fellow on our theme this morning from New York, who was the head of the Habitat affiliate there, saw a news announcement that he was coming to the city. And so he wrote a letter to Millard Fuller, who was the founder of Habitat, saying, I see President Carter is coming. Is there any way that we could get him to visit my job site because I'm having trouble getting volunteers for it? And Millard Fuller arranged for the president to come, and he took President Carter on a tour of it, and he took him up to the top of it. And it's actually a humorous story because there was no staircase in this building. It was a completely gutted apartment building. All the marble treads had been taken out by junkies who sold them, so there was no way to get to the roof. So they had built a rickety wooden staircase that at first the Secret Service did not want President Carter to go up on. But President Carter, I think, doesn't always listen to the Secret Service.
And he had a mission.
And so he went up to the roof, and he looked north. This was on the Lower East Side. He looked north, and he saw all the great office towers in midtown Manhattan, and looked south towards Wall Street and the pervasive sense of wealth that one gets from that, I'm sure, was at the top of his mind. And then he looked down into the vacant lot next to this abandoned apartment building, and there was a woman cooking over an open fire as though she were in the middle of the Third World. And when President Carter came back down the stairs, he said to this fellow, Rob DeRocker, he said, Rob, you let me know what I can do to help you. And Rob said, well, you know, Mr. President, if you could send some carpenters up here from your church, that would be an enormous
help. That would
help
a lot.
Wow.
Right.
And not only did the president do that, but he came with them. And that was the first Jimmy Carter Work Project.
Okay.
And President and Mrs. Carter have given a week every year since then. In November, they'll be going to Thailand, and that will be the 26th one.
Wow.
And those were that's what put Habitat on the map, because when President Carter showed up to work with his hands on an abandoned apartment building in New York City in 1984, everyone covered it. The New York Times sent reporters.
Right.
All three networks sent live remotes, and that's when people began to hear about Habitat. And now President Carter likes to say, you know, when I go on an airplane, people don't ask me about the Camp David Accords. People ask me, but tell me about Habitat.
Right.
That's great. What a great story. So your book, what's the goal of the book? What's the overall message?
Well, the goal of the book is to encourage people to become more involved with
service. It's for kids, right, like 9 and older?
It was written specifically for middle school kids, 9 mm-hmm. to 13. But I'm a former journalist, and the way I write for kids is to keep it simple,
right.
not to write in sing-song.
Sure.
So it's a book for both kids and adults.
Right.
Adults will just find it an easy read.
Right.
Sure. And great pictures, too. I'm looking at the book right now. Gosh, what an amazing research project this must have been for you. Any final stories to share with our listeners?
Yeah, anything from like the homeowner perspective, maybe share about how meaningful it is when they walk into that house and get the keys.
Well, I'll tell you something relatedly, which is that what I really hope for this book is that 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, young adults will start showing up on Habitat job sites and in the Peace Corps and all kinds of other things. And someone
mm-hmm.
will say, hey, what brought you here? You know, what inspired you? And they'll say, well, you know, when I was 12, I read this book.
Right.
And it really changed how I thought about the world, and I couldn't wait till I was old enough to be able to go out and make a difference.
That's nice.
That is so nice. You know, I'm participating in my first Habitat for Humanity project in about a month with my daughter. And it is. It's nice to have the opportunity. What age does somebody have to be to actually volunteer on site?
It depends where you are in the country because, as you know, Habitat has affiliates that set these rules. But it's either 16 or 18.
Right.
Got it. What a great way to be involved. And I love to see the fruits of my labor. That's why I like to mow the lawn.
Yes.
But to be able to build and then to be able to see the final product.
Right. And it's a short period of time. It isn't. Like it takes like a year. It's just in a few weeks.
It all depends on the affiliate. And there's some things they call blitz builds. Mm-hmm. And on a blitz build, 2 days.
Wow.
Gosh, how cool is that?
That's cool.
And why is it that it takes someone, you know, three months to do my kitchen? Wow, that's amazing. David, thank you so much for being with us today. The book comes out tomorrow, right?
That's right.
And it'll be available everywhere, I'm
sure. It's available everywhere.
And you'll be signing these books tomorrow.
Do you have a website, though?
The best place to go for this now is habitat.org.
Wow, okay. And tell us again the timing and when you'll be at the Jimmy Carter Library and Museum to sign the books.
It's tomorrow, Thursday the 15th, from 5 to 6 at the Carter Center. It's not at the library. It's at the Carter
Center. Okay. Terrific. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having
me. And for sharing. Gosh, can you imagine, Lee?
No.
How cool would that be to pull all that research together? And what a great cause. We're definitely shifting gears now, but still exciting information for our listeners. Next up, we have Sean Holland, and Sean Holland is with Capital Preservation Group. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Thanks for having me, Amy Lee.
So, Sean, this is a topic of conversation you might need to break down for our listeners into, how do we say, common speak, because you're a small captive insurance company, and just by saying that, some people don't even know what captive is. So,
sure.
Maybe break it down for us and just describe a little bit about what a captive insurance company is.
Sure. Captive insurance companies have been around for decades. They're just really coming more mainstream because the prices have come down to put them in place and to manage them. But in essence, what a captive is a small property and casualty firm that a business owner would own and control. Instead of writing a property and casualty premium to a third party, they would write one to their own entity. And they would get a deduction just like they would writing it to a third party. But the property and casualty firm can oftentimes be a very profitable business for them simply because they're insuring things that they were not insuring before.
Okay.
Typically, they won't insure things like general liability or workers' comp. We'll look for small holes in coverages. Most companies don't insure for kidnapping or an act of terror. Mm-hmm. Things that are real risks, they're there. People just decide not to formally insure them because either the risk is too low or the premium's too high.
So the risk is too low or the premium's too high. So how does the captive work? I mean, walk us through the process of this. Maybe
sure.
Go through the history and how it works now.
Sure. The history is really the House decided, the House of Representatives in D.C. decided that there should be tax neutrality when deciding on whether to self-insure or to insure through a third party. So in the past, if you decided to self-insure, there was no formal way to do that and get a deduction for doing so. So captives were put in place. Now, if I'm a business owner, I can decide whether or not I want to insure through a third party or insure through my own captive insurance company, which I own and control and can reap the profits of that small property and casualty company if I have a favorable claims history.
So now, like any business can do this?
That's
correct.
Or
certain industries are more suited?
Well, no, actually, we work across the spectrum, and really it's revenue-driven. Companies with $2 million in gross revenue and up are good targets mm-hmm. for us, but we work with companies from $500 million in revenue and down.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some very interesting risk management components, very interesting asset protection components, which I think we were talking a little bit earlier about physicians and physician groups. These are very popular in that space because they are looking for ways to protect their assets because they're in one of the most litigious areas of any
sure.
business.
Sure.
So how can they protect their assets through risk management and ownership in these captives?
And how much does it cost to set up a captive? Does it depend on the business size or the amount of risk?
It depends on really where they're domiciled. We do – most of our captives are formed offshore. Mm-hmm. St. Kitts, St. Martin, Nevis are very popular domiciles to set these up. Now, some people think, oh, no, offshore.
Mm-hmm.
But these captives are formed offshore and managed offshore, but all the assets are kept locally. So there's not any tax hanky-panky going on, I guess you'd say. We elect to be taxed as a U.S. corporation from day one. There's a certain election that we make that basically tells the IRS, hey, we're doing a captive, we're doing it in the right way, and we're following all the rules. Now, the cost of setting it up offshore is about $44,000 initially and about $20,000 a year to manage it.
Okay.
If we go domestically, because of the rules and regulations of each state tend to be a lot more onerous than those offshore, the price doubles in both of those capacities. So it's about 80 to set up and about 40 to manage per year.
So why aren't more businesses doing this?
Well, I think that in the past, cost has been a big prohibitive factor. Now, since so many are being formed, there are probably a dozen attorneys in the United States who are actually focusing in this area now. There is there's just a decrease in cost of setting them up because of the economies of scale are now in place. So when we looked for a client, we look really if they can afford $200,000 or more in premium payments per year to their own captive, then they are a good prospect for us. The maximum you can put in these small captives is $1.2 million a year, and that is a pretty high number for most businesses, but very profitable businesses look at this as an excellent opportunity to insure risks that they currently weren't insuring, and if they don't have any claims, they keep the profits of the company.
What about technology risk? Are you? Is that a hot topic now?
Absolutely. Particularly data loss, any sort of thievery from a third party on your data. I mean, there are lots of liabilities that exist in that world, and oftentimes are excluded on general liability policies.
Right.
So we look for holes in policies, and we do a comprehensive review of what they currently have in place. And then we find those holes, and whatever amount they're looking for, we can come up with a risk.
So now if you're spending, what'd you say, like $200,000 or $250,000 a year in premiums, then you're a good prospect for this kind of – you'll actually get a more robust insurance product and possibly make more money.
Well, yes. We really don't, I guess, look at someone's current expenditures on insurance as a telltale sign that they'll be a good prospect, because most of the time – you know, for a physician, he may be spending $250,000 a year for malpractice insurance if they're an OBGYN, but there are a whole bunch of other holes that they have in their coverage that they've just elected not to insure. Most likely it's because malpractice is so expensive.
High, right.
But there may be an opportunity for us to go in with a physician group and say, okay, instead of a $25,000 deductible on your general liability policy, why don't we increase your deductible to $100,000 instead of $25,000, save you a bunch of money in premium, and then we'll insure that deductible through your own captive.
Got it.
So there are opportunities to reduce costs, but moreover, use tax-favored dollars to pay claims should you need to.
Right. You mentioned tax dollars. Are there any unique tax implications when you set one of these up?
There are actually two things that we focus on. One is the initial deductibility of the premium. And they have to be actuarially certified premiums. Okay. So you can't just say, well, I'm going to do a kidnapping policy and it should be $500,000 a year.
Talk about that a little bit, because I'm sure our listeners, I mean, that I'm curious. What is that?
Sure. Well, typically we'll look at the person's – I'm sorry, you're meaning
the kidnap.
Right, the kidnapping thing.
Well, sounds scary.
It is. But if someone
goes – travel, I guess, to different countries, there's a lot of kidnapping.
There are actually industries – there are countries that have a cottage industry based around kidnapping people that visit their country.
Business owners, right?
Yeah, and particularly if you're visiting in a really nice resort.
Right.
Simply leave the resort and someone comes by and grabs you. I mean, it's becoming more prolific, which is scary. Central America has that industry. Mexico is seriously involved in that. It's even filtering over into Arizona right now that those coastal towns are some of the highest at risk for that. So if someone travels internationally a lot, then kidnapping is a real risk for them. And it's even a risk locally. Of course, it has to be a legitimate risk and a real risk in order to legitimize the premium.
Sure.
But our actuaries are very good at finding that out and justifying the premium based around the risk.
Okay. So back to the tax implications.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I just had to ask that about the kidnapping.
You're thinking about it?
Yeah. It was on my mind. I had to manage that risk in my mind.
Well, the tax implications, one is you get a deduction for making this premium payment to your own entity, which is very appealing. Before, if you were to have an event occur, let's say, for instance, the kidnapping did occur, well, you'd have to use after-tax dollars to pay if you decided that the person was valuable enough to pay the ransom, you would have to use after-tax dollars to pay that.
Right.
Now you have a formal policy in place so you can use pre-tax dollars to make those payments. So in essence, you're saving 40% on whatever that is. So you get a deduction for your premium up front, but these entities have very special tax consequences. The first $1.2 million of premium that go into captive per year is taxed at zero.
Okay.
There's no other business I know where you can have $1.2 million of revenue and pay no tax. Okay, so it's and the code section is specifically set up to help businesses self-insure.
Right.
So they offer these favorable tax consequences. And then when you pull the money out, we help people design exit strategies to make them tax efficient as well. But we do everything from entity formation, the management of the business, of the captive, and then exit strategy planning.
So this is very non-traditional.
That's correct.
You talk about the property and casualty side. Are you doing any of the self-insuring for large companies on the health side?
No, that's typically not what we do, mainly because there's a high level of risk.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of claims that are made on a regular basis.
Right. So you're specifically focusing on the property and casualty.
That's correct. And the lower probability risk that most likely these entities currently do not have insured in a formal sense. They're self-insuring because the risk is out there.
Sure.
But we find those risks, we formalize them through a policy, get a deduction, and then formalize the risks to their own property and casualty firm.
Okay. Any final thoughts for our listeners? I mean, that's a lot of information
sure.
in a short period of time. But
right.
if I understood it, I'm sure some of our listeners did too, because it is. When you start to talk about property and casualty and just even the word captive, and
sure.
I mean, there's a lot of terms that people aren't familiar with. How can people reach you?
Well, we have a website, www.cappg.com, and anyone can email me at sholland@cappg.com, and I'm happy to help them.
And then I'm sure the website has information to clarify.
Oh, sure, absolutely. They have we have limited information on captives and their formation, but if someone needs any more detail, then I'm
available
here in the Atlanta marketplace. Yeah,
great,
excellent. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks, y'all. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Thanks for being with us today. I learned a lot there. Next up, we have Karen Galambos, and almost everybody needs this type of service from time to time. They just don't know it. Karen is with RightType Pro Transcription Services. That's a mouthful. Say that five times fast. And Karen's here to talk to us a little bit about her business. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Thank you, Amy. Hi, Lee.
Hey.
So RightType Pro, they do high-quality comprehensive transcripts, but tell us about the types of clients you might have.
Well, we have many different clients. We transcribe teleseminars, podcasts, webinars, literary projects, personal notes. If someone needs to keep track of things and they don't want to write it down, they can just dictate it into a digital recorder. Focus groups, film production. It really can be used for anything. Anything audio or video can be put into text.
How'd you get into this? Good typist?
Yes. And computers interested me. And about 15 years ago, I was doing medical transcription, and I realized there was a great need for quality transcripts out there. It's very difficult to find someone who will actually take the time, do the research on your project, and try to spell things correctly, get the punctuation right, and make it a readable and usable transcript.
Right. A lot of people think, oh, I'll just get that, Dragon or one of those software things, and I'll just talk into that, and then, bam, I'll have this transcription. And in reality, those things are not accurate at all.
Well, voice recognition has come a long way.
Yes, but still, it's come a long way. It's still not accurate.
Yeah, it is not. You have to set that up yourself. It doesn't read the intonations of the voice. It's not quite there yet, and that's where we come in.
Right.
And how long have you been around? I mean, how long have you been doing this?
About 15 years.
Okay. What are some of the changes you've seen? You mentioned voice recognition, but are you using that at all?
No, not using voice recognition. For what I do, it's really intonation-based. People want a transcript that reads like someone speaks, and that's really important.
Yeah, that is so important.
Right.
It truly is, and voice recognition can't do that. I've also seen EMS, or electronic medical systems, mm-hmm. come about, which there are also some issues with, but it's also very profitable for the bottom line for medical centers. So medical transcription is on the way out, And that's what I actually started out in. So I transitioned over. And actually, this is quite interesting to me. For the past 15 years, I have learned so much.
Right. You get to hear all these great speakers and all these smart people.
I do.
Right?
I do. And you Maybe I'll be smart someday.
Well, I bet you do know. You've got to know a lot.
It's fascinating.
Or a little about a lot of things.
A little about a lot of things.
Because
that's right.
You were mentioning to me, too, the process of learning. When you're listening and then transcribing, your retention is probably greater.
You're double dipping.
Wow.
It's great.
Mm-hmm. So any transcription you've done that really sticks in your mind as, wow, that was really interesting?
Well, I'll tell you what. I had a client who contracted me to transcribe interviews, 150 interviews, and she was writing a book on weight loss, and she interviewed people who had lost over 100
pounds. Just regular
pounds.
People, right?
Mm-hmm, everyday people. Well, I'm listening, and I'm typing, and I'm losing weight. It's like, oh, wow,
it's
this
like
is
a
great.
Whole motivation.
Yeah.
And now you can write a book about losing
Fabulous.
Weight that's about listening to other people tell you about weight loss.
Or... That's right. I'm like, oh, no, only 150. I have some more weight to lose. Bring them on.
That's a neat story. So you can work with clients all over the country, right?
Yes. We're based in Atlanta, but nationwide, you know, with the
Worldwide,
Internet.
Worldwide, really, right?
That's true, with the Internet and being able to download MP3s and video files, it makes it great.
And what about outsourcing to India? What's that all about?
Well, there are a lot of transcription services based out of India, and what they do is they offer their service at really reduced rates. But their native language doesn't work well with the intonation, the colloquialisms, American English. It's very difficult, and you never get the same transcriptionist. So you don't build a relationship. Right. But, you know, you get what you pay for.
Right. And it's culturally, that can't be discounted. I had, when I was started out in business, a friend of mine's father was doing the, he would make sure that when Turner was doing their movies in Latin America, he would make sure that culturally that they were saying what they meant to say. Because things may seem like it's the same word, but it could have a totally different meaning.
Just doesn't translate.
Right. So that's what happens when you go offshore for this kind of stuff. It happens more time than you would think.
And it's important. It's your business.
Right.
It
it's how your it's your brand.
I've read transcripts before where they just don't make sense, and I've been told that that's why is that they're transcribed either from another language or by someone, maybe voice recognition. Type. And it doesn't. It's like what you just don't understand it. So I could definitely see the value in your service, and the colloquialisms. Those are so important. As Americans, we have a lot of them.
A lot,
right?
And I imagine in translation sometimes they may not be understood. So tell us a little bit about how people can contact you and maybe what just differentiates you other than just the voice recognition. We touched on that. But what makes you different from the other folks that do transcription services that I can't pronounce?
Well, we really strive. We have a commitment to personal service, and we want to build a relationship with the businesses and the people that we work with. We want to get them a transcript that they can use. We want it to be an add-on value for them.
That's an important thing. Like, what's a reason that you would need it? Like, why would a business owner want to transcribe maybe some audio that they've done? What's the benefit for them?
The biggest benefit is if you have a website and you post a transcript on the website, the search engine spiders troll all websites for content.
And like textual content.
That's exactly right. They only troll for text words. They do not for audio or video.
Or pictures, right.
Yet. They don't do that yet.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure that's coming. But so to have a transcript up on your website brings you higher in your SEO rankings.
Right.
Also, it takes less bandwidth for someone to download a text file than an audio or a video file.
And some people like to read. Some people like to listen. You know, you want to give the information in the manner that your customer wants to absorb it.
Sure.
There's a large deaf community out there also
who
don't have access to
just
audio.
So
right.
Wow. That's great. So how can people contact you?
My website is writetypepro.com, and anybody can contact me directly, Karen@writetypepro.com.
Okay, and you work with all different kinds of clients, too.
All different kinds of clients.
Mm-hmm. How
interesting. I do, and I enjoy it.
That's a great job for someone with attention deficit
disorder. How fast do you type? How many words per minute?
About 110.
Wow.
Gosh,
That's like amazing.
I'd love to see that. Wow.
Like, is that as fast as you think? How I have no concept of how fast that is.
It's pretty fast. It's pretty fast.
Like, so if you're
My mind goes a little bit quicker than that, and you have to hold back.
Really? I can't even imagine.
I can't either. Wow. What a unique service, too. Thanks so much for being with us today and for sharing.
Thank you.
And our listeners that have need for a transcription, definitely contact Karen. Thanks for being with us. Last but certainly not least, Lee, a lot of our listeners and a lot of folks in the business community have kids, don't we, right, Lee?
Absolutely.
And our next guest, Lori Light, is here to talk to us about stress-free kids. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Lori, I'm so happy.
Are you
that you're
stressed right now? Because you've been waiting a long time.
You have. I'm so
I'm
happy.
I'm actually not.
So did you go through any stress relief techniques while you were waiting?
I actually did. I was sitting here visualizing, and I almost took a deep breath, but I didn't want everyone to hear that on the mic.
So you're the creator of Stress-Free Kids. Tell us a little bit about this line of books and CDs that you've designed.
Well, I created an entire line of books and CDs that help children manage stress, anxiety, and anger while promoting more peaceful sleep and their self-esteem. I also have a CD for teenagers and adults, and I actually brought a gift for you, too.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
giving you an adult that. Relaxation tape called Indigo Dreams.
You know we have kids.
Oh, well, I can get you those, too. Get you hooked up.
It's so important, too, because I know we are stressing our kids out. I try so hard not to, but, you know, to some listeners, it may be a new concept that kids would be stressed. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's true. I think just recently this issue of stress with children is coming to light. It took a long time for people to realize that children are vulnerable to stress, and actually they're even more vulnerable than adults because often adults have been taught coping techniques or they can sign up for a yoga class. Children don't not only do they not have that available to them as readily, but they also don't know how to express that they are feeling stress. I mean, Emmy, if you're stressed out, you say to your friend, you know, let's go have a glass of wine. I'm stressed out. You know, kids don't really talk to each other about being stressed out. So we're starting to put the words on it and to the emotions and let children know about it. And I'm here to show children that they can actually manage their own stress through stories.
And what's your background to kind of make these connections?
I am a mom that was really stressed out while raising her three children, and I actually had a son that used to take me 2 hours, yes, I said 2 hours, to put to sleep every single night. I was so stressed I became sick. My young daughter developed stress-related night terrors. My husband and I were fighting. I mean, it was not a happy house.
And why was it so hard to get her to sleep?
My son was hyperactive, and he had severe allergies and was chronically ill from the allergies. So he would basically be jumping on the bed for 2 hours while I was trying to settle him down. So I learned to do some relaxation techniques myself that had an immediate effect on me. And they were so simple that I started to wonder, you know, what would happen if I could get my son to do the same techniques? So one night, about an hour and a half into our dilemma, I began to create a story that not only entertained him, but incorporated an actual stress management technique. And to my amazement, my son followed along and fell asleep. And I almost cry when I tell this story because it was just changed our lives. And when I came out of the room, my husband, you know, he had noticed how quiet things were, so he came to listen in.
Right.
He heard the story, and he said, "Lori, you have got to write that down. That is incredible. You can help thousands of children and parents." So
and
I did.
That's where it all started?
I did.
By necessity, but kind of accidentally.
Accidentally. Well, one of those beautiful accidents that right. you keep talking about.
Now, I understand it wasn't an accident, though, that you were on ABC's Shark Tank. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I was. I'm a little bit of a local celebrity now.
You're
I love it.
A reality star.
And yes, and in fact, I'm so grateful to be here because I really want to give a shout out to Atlanta and thank them for all their support. I mean, because of Atlanta, you know, I I want to attribute them to, I'm getting into Borders now. So wow. Everybody, keep supporting me. Go out to Borders. Ask for my books. And one of the tools that I used to convince Borders was that my YouTube segment has had over 17,000 hits.
Wow.
And it is the highest watched YouTube segment from the Shark Tank episode. So, and that's, you know, everyone from Atlanta did that for me, and I'm so grateful. So let's keep going, guys. Let's rally on.
What was it like, though?
Yeah, just kind of, in case people aren't familiar with Shark Tank, why don't you briefly just kind of say what that's about?
Shark Tank is an ABC Mark Burnett production, and it is a chance for entrepreneurs like myself to get out in front of five ruthless investors and pitch my business in hopes that they will believe in the growth potential and invest. So I really got to experience stress. I had to walk down a really long hall and stand there in front of them not knowing what I was getting into and pitch my business, which was the first time I ever did that.
Really?
Wow. It was.
That's nerve-wracking by itself. Forget about the TV audience just to do that.
It was incredibly nerve-wracking. And then I expected one of the sharks, you know, you do your research, right. And I expected one of them in particular, Kevin, to be the one that would be interested. And it turns out he's the Simon Cowell of the group.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and he totally threw me off my game because he started pretty much knocking me down. You know, right. I was getting hit with hammers, and I totally did not expect that. But I actually used one of my relaxation techniques on the sharks.
Uh-huh.
I read from Angry Octopus, and I had them do progressive muscular relaxation. It's so funny on the clip. You can see Robert Hirschfeld saying, so, you know, at least I got to relax a few sharks. I actually got a deal with Barbara Corcoran, and we are working on that now, and I'm hoping to go to New York really soon and, you know, hash out the details of the deal. And
were you surprised? I didn't watch your episode, but I kind of know how this works, with the amount of money, with the amount of that you had to give up for this, because that's what entrepreneurs don't realize. In their head, they're like, well, I do all the work, and then in reality, you're not keeping as much as you think you're going to keep.
How about the word shock? You know, I think that for season two, it won't be as shocking for the contestants.
Well, right, because you took the hit for them.
We took the hit, and we kind of exposed the secret there. But no, none of us had seen any shows prior to this. We had no idea that they would be coming back with numbers like 50%, 51%, 70%, I have heard. So no, I mean, and I kind of wish I knew, because I had spent hours and hours and hours with those numbers trying to figure out a really appropriate percentage.
What did you think in your head was like, oh, I'd be willing to give up this percent? What'd you think?
You know, I went in at 25 and I figured I'll go up to 35 depending what they bring to the table.
Right. Hmm. And that was, and they wanted 50% or no deal, right?
They wanted 50 or no deal. I almost lost the deals because I tried to negotiate, which now I notice on the show, they do negotiate more. But back then it was like, I'm a dinosaur. as soon as you mention negotiating, they pull their table, their deals off the table. And that shocked me too. So it was really
quite a roller coaster. That was hardball.
Yeah, apparently I wasn't the best negotiator in the world because I gave him 50%. But listen, you know what? If I can help more children and get these
books out there, that's the bottom line, right?
That's what it's all about. And the opportunity to have national exposure was just tremendous.
Right.
And look, that's why you're talking to me.
Exactly.
Exactly. Gosh.
It was a great story, and we're real proud of you. You did
a great job.
Yeah, absolutely. Great job representing Atlanta, and women, too. Women entrepreneurs. I think it's just such an important...
And who knows what doors this is going to open in other areas. I mean...
Exactly. That the main thing that is happening is all the doors that are opening, and people that really were hard for me to talk to before, they want to talk to
me
now.
Exactly. Now
so you know what? I'm going to play that Shark Tank card as long as I can.
Exactly.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. People can find your books where?
At www.stressfreekids.com. But also, don't forget Borders. I really want to support them. They're the first ones to give me a chance. They're my first retail relationship. So
that's
go
great.
Out to Borders. Ask for Angry Octopus. I have lots of other titles. And let's start relaxing families.
That's awesome. I love it.
Yeah. I love it. That's wonderful. I love what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Lori. And we hope folks will definitely check out the Stress-Free Kids. Lee, jam-packed show.
I know.
Wonderful. What a great lineup of guests today.
Yeah, it was really amazing people.
Yes. Until next week, I'm Amy Otto with the Atlanta Business Radio Show.